Welcome to the Everyday PM podcast, the podcast where we discuss project management principles for your everyday life. My name is Ann Campia, and I'm a certified project/program manager with a decade of experience working for healthcare, retail, consumer goods, and tech industries. I'm so excited to welcome Brendan Baker, who is the author of the bestseller Valuable Change and consultant on over $10 billion projects in key transformations and programs across a range of industries and organizational sizes. Brendan, you've also established the Valuable Change Company with one central mission in mind, which is to help change leaders drive real value. But on your way to your secondary mission, which is to fight unnecessary complexity. So I love that. I love the 1-2 combo you got there, Brendan. So why don't you take a brief moment to introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you've actually covered half of it there, which is great. But I'm Brendan Baker. I'm actually based in, somewhat sunny. It's currently dark because it's 5 a.m. my time here. But I'm based in Canberra, on the outskirts of Canberra, down in Australia. So coming to most of your listeners, I would imagine, from a fair while away. But yes, absolutely. Started the Valuable Change Co. with really one key mission in mind, that was to help change leaders drive real value. And it's because it's so easy to get caught up in the process. It's so easy to get caught up in the templates or the reports or the documents or whatever it is. And we really, when we're driving change, we really lose sight of why we're doing it and what we're actually trying to achieve. And so that's what the Valuable Change Co. is designed to combat. And as you said, and counter some unnecessary complexity on the way.
I love that. And your mission and what you believe in with the Valuable Change Co. is just very, very strong. And I think a lot of our audience will resonate with that as well. So I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts today. I think for today, we're going to spotlight you, obviously, but we're also going to focus on your newest book, which is called High Value PMOs. And I think in this environment, this current climate where we're seeing the project management industry continue to shift and evolve, and with the newest edition of the PMBOK coming out, the 7th edition, with the focus of it really being on value-driven principles and how we can arrive there, your book is so timely. I'll start there. Did you plan that? Did you plan for this to happen, or is this a happy coincidence?
Absolutely. I'm a master scheduler. No. in many ways, no. So the book is really, the timing is a coincidence, in all honesty. But the book, which I think we'll explore it, throughout this discussion, but really this book is the result of I guess my experience to date. And seeing what works and seeing what doesn't work. So it seems like that there might just be a little bit of a value revolution happening at the moment and happening all around the globe. So that's really the result of that.
Yeah, I love that value revolution. I think that's absolutely appropriate. And I think a lot of us, titled project manager or not, we're looking internally to say to ourselves, what is my value add to the organization? And in this respect, as we dig into your book, what is the PMO overall? What is it adding to the organization overall? And if it's not doing that, why? And I like that you dig into that exact concept, because I think that's a question that we should all be asking ourselves right now. So I'm on that train, Brendan, about value revolution. I think we're there. So why don't we start with your background? I would love to hear, how did you arrive at being a project manager? You also have a lot of experience that you're bringing into each of the books that you've written. So tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to. So it's one of those funny things where fairly early on, I knew that my career was going to be guided by two principles. And they were just two things that were really, really important to me, almost my value set. And the very first thing was that I knew that anything I did needed to be driven, I guess, with purpose. Basically, I needed to help make people's lives better. Right. And I quite liked change. I was quite adaptable. So I knew I was going to be drawn into that arena a little bit. And the second one was that I thrive on variety and diversity. So anything that I did had to be different fairly frequently, new contexts, new people, new environments, new problems to solve. They were the value sets coming in. And I admit, I actually grew up in a house in a low socioeconomic part of Sydney. with a mum that was a teacher and a dad that had a trade. So there was nothing, I guess, corporate about my upbringing. I had no exposure to it, but I knew that I wanted to get into that business world and crack into it. But with that value set, I was actually drawn to project management. The idea of, and I'm talking very, very, when I was drawn to it, it was very cursory in my understanding, but it was really just the idea of something having a defined start and end date that was highly appealing because it built in that variety, it built in that diversity. And so that's where I started. I went through, got a business degree and started as a graduate in a PMO of all places and kind of learnt the game from the PMO. And then the whole time I was there, I was begging, give me a project of my own, give me a project of my own. I can do this. I want to cut my teeth, as you do when you have that youthful exuberance. You know, yes, I'm invincible. I can do it all. And I finally got one, which was awesome. I had a fantastic mentor at the time and got given a project to take on. It was small, but tell you what, I'm glad it was small. The amount of mistakes I made on that thing were the list is endless. But nevertheless, delivered it. And so then the projects and programs, it kind of, as I say, you know, it's almost history. It cascaded in size. And so I've actually delivered either directly leading myself or consulting on or guiding in one way or form projects, programs, and portfolios in various sizes. We're talking everything from, you know, 50, 100K all the way up to a $1.5 billion portfolio and everything in between. It's good fun, to be honest, and across a range of different types of projects as well, which is really interesting. Again, meeting that need for diversity. And we're talking process overhauls, we're talking IT systems, new and existing. We're talking restructures, shared service implementations, call center uplifts. What else have I done? Public infrastructure. So a whole heap of things, but there's also been some really interesting, unique ones as well. And it's funny because they're the ones that you get the really cool stories from. So one of which was actually state archives. The people that have all of the documents that no one else wants to anymore, unless they want to go and look at history. The problem was the state archives, they had a deep, I guess, several warehouses of all of these documents, and they had no idea what they had. And the crazy thing is that's actually the status quo. That's the norm for archives and libraries across the world. In fact, the benchmark at the time was about 20% cataloged, 80% of their archives are just boxes. They have no idea what they have. Now, this state archives in particular was sitting at 8%. Accessible, 92% of what they had, they couldn't get to. And so the project was really throw money at the problem to try to, get what they could there. And so it was quite interesting because it was essentially cataloging archives, but at scale. And when you implemented, and what I did is I implemented agile principles and a bunch of other things in there. And delivered 5.5 times their expected scope. And blew them away. So they were targeting 100,000 archives and we did 550,000 in 4 months, which was amazing. So it's been a quite a unique journey, to be honest.
Yeah. And your career, is not ending anytime soon. So this is just a plethora of very, very unique and different types of projects that you worked on. And I imagine that's kind of what helped you write some of the books that you've already published in terms of your collective experiences there. But I want to go back to the very first thing you said, because it stuck with me, which is you were probably the first person on this podcast to ever say you recognize that you like change. And you know, it's for the everyday, even for the everyday person, right? Maybe you're not even a PM. This is just in your everyday life. Change can be very scary. And yes. I think when you are a project manager by title or not, that the trying to embrace change is something that can be very difficult for some people, which is also why you don't see everybody going into project management. I think when you recognize that's what we do, you either know or you don't that you can handle that type of pressure and that exactly. type of flexibility and commitment, whatever else that you need to invest in yourself. And it just sounds like as soon as you cut your teeth on that first project, you were ready to go, Brendan. And that's amazing. And for those that are, you know, still starting out fresh in the industry, what is your recommendation actually in terms of you got the trust of your stakeholders to give you your initial project, but after that, what did you do to have to start to diversify your portfolio, like everything that you've outlined to us?
Yeah, and I don't know if this will be controversial advice or not, to be honest, but I was, I was fairly aggressive in my career approach is probably the right way to put it. And so whenever I saw the formation of a glass ceiling, whenever I saw something in terms of, okay, whenever there was a knockback, go for a project and don't get put on the position that I was looking to get put on or whatnot, I looked lateral. And bounce lateral essentially, and that's what's really advantageous about the project management industry, is because everything has to find start and ends. There's endless opportunity, and it's funny, you mentioned change, and it's the old adage, change is the only constant, and so because of that, the industry is not going to change too much in terms of that nature. There will always be opportunities, and so I would absolutely be encouraging. Encourage people, get as far as you can where you are, but look laterally. It's okay. And look for your next opportunity, because that is the nature of the industry.
Yeah, that's great. And it's such a great way to just make sure you continue to diversify. You don't necessarily have to always be looking up. So I love that. That's a great piece of advice for those that are trying to figure out, how do I kind of unstick myself from being stuck with the same types of projects, right?
Yes.
So, but let's get back to, in the span of your career, it sounds like you've worked with different organizations, different types of structures, and now you've written this book on high value PMOs. So yes. Is there a reason why your focus of your new book now is how to create high value PMOs versus maybe one of the hundreds of other topics you could have written on?
And it really is the culmination of it's culmination experience, but really there was almost a defining moment a few years back where I was brought on by a client to help mature their PMO, and I jumped on to their file archives because I was curious. And I was curious around what's the history here, how many attempts have they already had at setting up a PMO, because you hear rumors that we've tried this in the past, and it's useful to know because it lets you know what level of change resistance you're likely to encounter when you're trying to roll out a new PMO. And so go and do a delve, and I saw that they'd had 6 different attempts already. Oh, wow. over 10 years at trying to do this. And so I almost put on an archaeologist hat, and I started to dig through the remains. Mm-hmm. and a pattern started jumping out. So then I paid attention, and that was kind of that little trigger. And I paid attention at all of my PMO clients past that point. I delved through, what are their history and what are the patterns? And it, increasingly so, there was a pattern that kept jumping out to me. And it's something that I've termed the administrative death cycle, which is a grim name. And I know that, but really, it captures what's happening, and I'll quickly walk you through it if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah.
So typically what will happen, that cycle will start with, there'll be some kind of trigger point, normally a new executive or some sort coming in. An executive will look around, and there are projects underway, and there's a whole heap of things going on, but there's no clarity. There's a sense of chaos typically. And so they'll look around, and they'll say, look, no one knows what's going on. We need a PMO. And so a PMO will get set up, and the PMO will say, okay, well, we'll set up our charter, and our mission will be, we'll drive consistency and visibility or something similar to that. And so they set up metrics, and they set up reports and a template library and a bunch of things. And then a few months go by, and the PMO looks around at all the projects and says, look, we know where they're up to, but no one's improving. And so they say, no one's improving. We need more assurance. We need to tighten the screws more. And so they basically increase the rigor. they, you know, tighter gates, heavier templates, that kind of thing. And to the point where, you know, that progresses for a while, but it essentially gets to the point where the projects start to say, look, this is getting overly cumbersome. Yeah. And we're no longer able to focus on the delivery, but we're stuck focusing on all of the PMO processes. And it gets to the point where essentially they start subverting the processes.
Mm-hmm.
And they start finding shadow workarounds, or they ask for forgiveness, you know, after the fact, just so they can still get their projects done. And the process essentially don't meet the needs of the organization. And someone somewhere with enough clout says to an executive, this PMO, they're not adding any value. They're expensive and they're cumbersome. Why do we have them?
Mm.
And ultimately the PMO is disbanded. And then the organization stays like that for a little while until a new trigger point, a new executive comes in, looks around, sees chaos and says, we need a new PMO, or we need a PMO. And the cycle kicks back off again. And I saw that. I saw that across as I delved through the history of these client sites. I saw this cycle happening again and again and again. And you can see it, you know, the templates and the gateway documents and all of these things getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And so I wrote this book because I saw that. And I also saw what was working both in the PMOs that I was implementing, but also the PMOs that I'm working alongside of on other projects and other change.
Mm-hmm.
And it was essentially what I termed those high value PMOs. And they had broken out of the cycle. And the way to break out of the cycle really is at a fundamental point, but you can do so anytime your PMO exists, but it's really, it's a shift in thinking. And the thinking is, instead of thinking the project's unimproving, we need more assurance, the shift of thinking is the project's unimproving, how can we improve capability? And how can we better support them? And how can we better serve them? And when you have that shift in thinking, you're no longer thinking about tightening the screws and making harder gateways and you know, trying to, I guess, force them through a tight and nasty funnel. But you're now thinking about, well, this is my client base. How do I help them achieve success? And you enter what I call the high value service cycle. So you start with the clarity of who you're serving. You start with clarity of why you exist. And then you essentially pivot around a very simple cycle, which is you're delivering services and support for your internal clients, which are typically executives and project managers and whatnot. And then you look, then there's a point of self-reflection. How can we better serve these people? How can we tighten the screws on ourselves in terms of minimizing our own effort while maximizing reward to these groups? And then cycle within there. And that is where a high value PMO exists.
And so you've come in, you've recognized this, you've kind of, as you said, like an archaeologist or excuse me, like a medical doctor, you've come in and essentially kind of got down to what is the prognosis of the client. How do you have that conversation to say, I recognize there's some mistakes that your PMO is making. How do we step back and take a look at that? What is that conversation like?
So it's funny. It's the kind of thing that I typically tell the story of the cycle. And if this is a person that has been around projects and change for at least a few years. I mean, when I was telling the story of the cycle here, you were there nodding your head.
Oh yeah, because I lived through one as well. That resonated with me. So.
and that's the thing. The most people that have been around change in projects have likely seen this. And so as soon as you tell the story, and storytelling is very powerful, and I might touch on that later, but as soon as you tell the story of, okay, well, this is the typical life cycle of a PMO, you see that recognition, you see that the lights go on. And then you draw a little exit path for them. So, you know, I love whiteboards. I don't have one here, but I love whiteboards. And I'll typically put it in front of them. And then you draw the little exit path and you say, this is where we should be exiting. And this is where we should be existing instead. And to be honest, that gets the conversation happening rather quickly and really clearly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And exactly. Nodding my head for that exact reason. As you were telling that story, I recognize that I have that exact same story in my history as well. And it's unfortunate because, you know, when I was starting out, one of the pieces of advice that I don't know if it's advice, it's really just kind of a statement that was made to me as a project manager was, you know, are you sure you want to be in this role? Because usually when organizations start to find faults, they look at their PMO first. And that is usually the group that gets targeted first or gets cut first. And it was just a very real conversation I had early on in my career about, is this something that you do? Are you okay with this type of instability? And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not doing a great job, but it could be some sort of organizational change that forces the PMO out. And so your story is absolutely hitting home for me. I'm sure for those that are listening as well, they can think of an example or have lived through that as well. So I can see how that conversation can become very, very easy for you as you put your yes. your visual in front of these stakeholders and talk through it. So that's wonderful. What about, you know, you talk a little bit about, is this the biggest mistake that PMOs make? Is there a laundry list of things that you kind of put in front of the stakeholders to say, here's X, Y, and Z where I think we're failing? What does that look like?
Great question. So there are typically four, I call them cultural traps that PMOs can fall into. And I'll delve into a little bit more detail on a couple of them. But the four traps are essentially, number one, building an ivory tower. This idea of the PMO being better than everyone around them and having the ultimate source of truth on all things. The second is not getting the balance right between dictatorial approach, what I call a dictatorial monopoly, or a benevolent monopoly, as in they'll try to be all things to all people, or there'll be no things to anyone. The third trap is stagnation. Which is essentially a disconnect between your PMO and the context of your environment. You're no longer providing value because essentially you're disconnected from them. And it's because you've been left behind. And that's that stagnation. Or the fourth element is that they're paralyzed by fear. And there's a multitude of fears that affect us in our organizations on day-to-day life, and we're humans. We're quite fallible, sure. And so it's the inability to move forward because we're stuck in fear. But there's two. I mean, to bring this back, I want to talk about the first two more so here. The first is the building the ivory tower mentality. Now that typically manifests in one of two ways. The first is an us and them style approach or a style of thinking or culture within that can be built into a PMO. And I'll give an example here. A PMO client a few years back brought me in to help mature their PMO processes. And on the very first day that I was there, the second in charge of the PMO came up to me. And as part of her initial debrief to me, she said, The project managers in this organization are all idiots and they don't know what they're on about. That in itself
Yikes.
Was, yes, exactly. Yes. And so that in itself was proof of this us and them. It was immense us and them style mentality. It was very adversarial. And it's that, I mean, that's the epitome of it, but I've seen it many, many times. And so that's a key way that an ivory tower mentality can start to encroach in our PMOs. The other way that an ivory tower can turn up is through what I call academic self-gratification. And you'll have to excuse the cheeky title, but essentially, and I've got an example here as well, but that's essentially being so obsessed with having your own things perfect that you lose touch of reality. Okay. And the example here is, again, it was a PMO client brought me in to actually look at and improve their assurance programs. But when I got in, I saw that they had all of these frameworks on basically in their file structure. They had all of these frameworks and templates, and they'd been sitting there refining these frameworks and templates for 15 months, and none of them had been rolled out. None of them had any, basically no project manager even knew that they existed. No program. This was a multitude of portfolios sitting under this EPMO. And no one knew that these frameworks existed because this EPMO kept spinning their wheels and basically getting more and more academic, that they were all experts at the textbooks and they wanted to build the silver bullet, the perfect framework. And in doing so, essentially rendered themselves useless for that 15 months. And, wow. And again, yes. So again, ivory tower. because they were trying to build the perfect solution. And so the ivory tower is interesting because it's actually counted quite easily. It's counted quite simply. It counted through two ways, empathy and experience.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah,
so
that makes sense.
Yes. And so what I've found is that majority of these ivory tower PMOs are staffed by people that haven't necessarily delivered a project before. And so they're coming from somewhere else and they go,
isn't
hey, you
funny?
Know, you're good. Sorry?
Isn't that funny?
Yes.
Just, I don't know. I guess I have to laugh or otherwise I cry knowing that, but that I think that is absolutely true.
Yes. And you can't blame them because they're essentially, they come in from somewhere else. They're good at processes or they're good at people or something. And they got given a handbook. Look, you know, this is project management. Here's your textbook. Read that. And then I want you to make sure other people can do it. That's essentially their brief. And so they come from it, you know, using that textbook often as a point of truth, but they get stuck. And so empathy and experience is absolutely the counter. What's really cool is that you can build in processes and very simple processes into almost any PMO to build in that empathy and experience to counter that ivory tower, no matter where you are on in your life cycle, your PMO life cycle. And so the first thing you could do to build in empathy is co-design. And so get the stakeholders in the room. If you're working on a template, if you're working on a report, if you're working on a process, if you're refining it, if you're doing reflection, whatever it is, get the stakeholders in the room with you. You'll start to immediately build empathy. That's the first one. Very, very insanely simple, but people aren't doing it. The second one is around experience. And so the key process that you could be looking at there, and this is highly effective, is you look at building in some form of shadowing or rotation. And so you rotate the PMO staff out into the delivery. You give them a project to run or three, or you have them shadow people that are running projects. And then you cycle project managers into the PMO. And when you get that cycle happening, you're getting the fresh blood in straight from the coalface as such. And so you're getting the scars and the experience with that and embedding that in, which helps your continuous improvement. But you're also keeping that experience cycle happening, and you're breaking those that could rely on the textbook overly much when they get into reality and they see, look, I don't have time to manage all of my different, 300 different logs. I don't have time to do this because I'm busy fighting fires all day. And then maybe I'll, update a risk at the end of the day or run a retrospective or whatnot. They get that sense of the imperfection in the reality of running a project because there is never enough hours in the day. When you're running a project. And so that really is that ivory tower counter. You put empathy, you build in that empathy and you build in that experience. The second mistake I'll touch on fairly quickly as well is really that it's this finding this balance in terms of the type of monopoly you want to run, because the majority of PMOs are running an internal monopoly. And that's not a bad thing that what they are doing, ideally you want to be in that place because that means there's not duplication throughout the organization. So you want to be running a monopoly, but with great power comes great responsibility, right?
Love that line. Yes.
And so a high value PMO finds the balance between, dictatorial and benevolent. So a dictatorial monopoly is one that is, would reject forms or reject processes or gateway submissions because of spelling errors, right? That's the absolute, high end of this command and control style dictatorial monopoly. The other end of the world is the PMO that doesn't know how to say no. Yes, we can do it. Yes, we can do it. Yes, we can do it, to the point of never being able to get anything done. And so a high value PMO is one that strides the two and finds what I call the balance in what I call the responsible monopoly. In that they're continually asking themselves three key questions. They're asking themselves, how do we maximize the reward to our client groups, our internal client groups? Mm-hmm. How do we minimize the pain of dealing with us? And how do we minimize our own effort in delivering our internal services? And when you ask those three questions, you're getting that lovely positioning between the two, because you're focused on this is what we do and we know what we do. we're clear on that. And then we're continually looking at ways to do it better, both for our clients and for ourselves. And that's the angle forward.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, that's great. Because it really does have to be some sort of reciprocation on both sides of the coin, right? I don't know if that's the right saying, but yeah, it absolutely makes sense that you should be looking to do that across the board. So I think all of these resonated again, because you saw me nodding my head again as you're telling these stories. And I'm like, uh-huh, yep, I remember that. I remember that also happening. So I imagine if we saw the audience that's listening to this podcast right now, they would also be nodding their heads as well, because you're just saying all the things that I feel like as project managers we've experienced. We just never, I don't know, I just never really put it together that could be, you know, the trend across multiple different PMOs, you know. But since you've had that perspective, it's fantastic that you've had the opportunity to now kind of see that is an actual common trend across those PMOs that you've seen that are failing. And it's really, really fascinating that it is, you know, down to those simple things. It really kind of is that simple, the way that you've outlined them in your book. So it's just interesting. It's hitting the part of my head that I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't even think about it in that way. So then, you know, you talk about these are the areas that you would bring up to the stakeholders. This is potentially why we're failing as a PMO. Now let's talk about kind of the great side of things, right? Like, what have you seen the most successful PMOs do right? And what have you actually also had a hand in to help those PMOs get there?
Absolutely. Again, awesome question. So really, high-value PMOs are very, very clear. And they're clear on a couple things. In particular, they're clear on why they exist. They're clear on who they serve. They're clear on the value that they offer to those people that they serve. And they're clear on how they offer that value. That really is, you know, in many ways, that's the secret. It's being clear and achieving that clarity up front or as early as you possibly can. I mean, we've talked about the admin death cycle. We've talked about breaking out of that. But it's building in that clarity and that mentality in terms of a PMO is ultimately, and whether or not the PMO is including delivery or not into their model, it's ultimately a service driven part of the organization and should be. And so it's building in that clarity and asking yourself, you know, who are we serving? Who are our internal client groups? And what do they need from us to succeed themselves? What value does that give them? And how do we best serve that? And you mentioned, you know, what I've had a hand in. What I often recommend in this space is actually codifying it, doing that mapping process, you know, getting the stakeholders, getting those internal client groups in the room and say, look, this is what we think you need, but let's actually work through this and doing that mapping process with them. And then codifying that initially into an internal service map and making that available. And it's funny, what I'm talking to a lot of newer PMOs about now is, you know, I mentioned the value revolution. They're starting to understand, okay, yes, we need to be offering value. And some of them are going, yes, you know, we're fairly fit for purpose. We're nice and aligned. And so I'm starting to talk to them around push versus pull services. And at the moment, most PMOs that I've at least am talking to are still pushing services out.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, here's the template, here's the framework, here's this. They're pushing it out to their internal groups. While I'm chatting to them about what would a pull service look like here? How do you make your offering so appealing that your internal client groups are actively going to want to use it, actively going to want to seek you out? And not just the people that are seasoned, you know, like yourself, who would see the value in a PMO just because you understand why they exist and whatnot, but, you know, the newbies as well. How do you make yourself valuable to the newbies? Mm-hmm. Or how do you make yourself valuable to the executives who have, you know, barely a moment to spare? It's finding and maximizing that value to your internal client groups.
How challenging has that conversation been? Because I think the way you've, okay, so I'm going to go back to your story because it's still so vivid in my mind. If this is a cycle and you know, you're prescribing the medication to the patient of what you need to do to kind of essentially get out of the cycle. You've talked about what makes a PMO great. Now, some PMOs, I think, can plateau or something like that, where now you're talking to them about, well, here's an area of push-pull where we can continue to maximize our value add to the company. It's this idea of like continuous improvement, even within ourselves, individuals, projects, groups, et cetera. Now we're talking PMO. Where I'm going with this is PMOs can absolutely just get stagnant in what they're doing, right? Especially the best of them. And so when you're having this conversation with the kind of the best of the PMOs that you worked with, and you're saying, well, actually there's another area we haven't dug into yet. How receptive are they to that? Are they kind of pushing back and saying, no, we're good. You know, Brendan, you've done enough for us. We're good. You can leave us alone. Or are they pretty open to that? And then have you seen that change actually happen?
Yes, I have. And there's a primary tool that I use in that space. And so I actually fundamentally typically offer these PMOs a challenge. And I've got a model, it's in my other book, Valuable Change, called the Learning Levels. And essentially we are, any organization, any branch, any unit, whichever way you slice and dice this, is at one point of one of three learning levels. They're either A, ignorant, and I'm not calling them ignorant as such, but in terms of their learning processes, they're ignorant, or they're B, intelligent, or they're C, wise. Now, an ignorant organization or branch or unit, or in this case, PMO, is one that doesn't know what they're learning and doesn't do anything with it. Mm-hmm. A intelligent one has vast files, vast, you know, digital files of all of the things that they've learned, but they don't do anything with it. Mm-hmm. And a wise one knows what they're learning, knows where it's stored, knows how to search it, and ultimately uses it for forecasting and finds ways to prove it. And so, you know, we're talking about, you know, how do I have that conversation? Typically, I put those three those learning levels again on a whiteboard, or as a minimum, I describe it to them. And I say, where do you think you are? And what's really scary about the PMO arena when we're chatting stagnation, when we're chatting learning, is the majority of them are sitting in the ignorant box. And it's interesting because the whole idea of lessons learned with Agile, you know, retrospectives, the whole idea there is that projects learn from other projects and we continually learn. And that's built into no matter whatever methodology you're using in the project arena, that's built in. Now, whether or not they're actually being used and they're actually wise is a slightly different conversation, but either way, it's built in. The PMOs, which are supporting that delivery, aren't building in that same lessons learned or retrospective or looking back style they're not building in reflection typically mm-hmm. into their own processes. So that they're expecting, in fact, I've seen this quite often where the frameworks will say, you know, every project as part of their gateway review must have XYZ lessons learned log, must incorporate it into their closure report, must report it include it in yeah. whatever the template is. But then they don't do anything like that themselves, which blows my mind a little bit, which is really interesting. So we're chatting about, you know, how do we build that learning in? And really there's three key elements that I've found that are highly effective at building that in. First of all, consider where you are on the learning levels and think about, well, how do we move ourselves up those levels? But then it comes down to three key elements. The first is the right frame. And the right frame here is that a lesson log is not a lesson learned. Just because you've written something down or it's sitting in a report somewhere doesn't mean that the organization has actually learned from it.
Yeah, very true.
And so it's really building in that idea of learning proof. How do we actually prove that we've learned this? And the way you prove it is typically by not doing it again or doing it again, if it's a good thing or a bad thing. And so it's thinking around, it's almost bringing in this benefits management or this proving style thinking in terms of, okay, well, we've got all these lessons here. And maybe the top three are XYZ. How do we make sure we learn from that? How do we prove that? And it's starting to get that proving type of thinking into the lesson arena, which I could almost say, you know, hand on heart, that 90% of the people I talk to aren't doing. 95% of people aren't thinking in that way. And because it's a challenge and it takes time, but ultimately it's worth it. Now, the second element here is the right context. Now, the right context here is one of, I talk a little bit about a culture of openness, and it comes through in my books, but it also, you know, comes through in my conversations, is I often talk to organizations about building in a culture of openness. And so you want a culture where, you know, you're funding growth, you're funding experimentation, you're funding that, and you want to allow that within your PMO. You want to allow your PMO to make mistakes. And in fact, when I talk learning, if you look at any organization, any branch that's learning well and growing well, ultimately it's doing three things. It's failing and learning from it. It's succeeding and it's learning from it. And it's forecasting and reflecting, and it's learning from that too. And so you build those in and you normalize failure and you normalize success. And there's really simple ways to do that. You know, have a failure session here in Australia. I'm sure you might have it over there. You've got this idea of a wooden spoon where you celebrate the person that came last. And so, you know, and you're not necessarily ridiculing them or anything like that. It's okay to fail, and you're still part of the family. And in fact, so, something I have rolled out actually is what I call failure sessions, where you get the team together end of the week and you all, quite openly and in a lighthearted way, express your biggest failure of the week and what you learned from it.
I love that.
And you go around the room. It needs to be lighthearted. And it's like, that's a massive caveat on that one. It has to be very lighthearted. And it, like, if you have a culture that's has a tendency to become condescending, do not go anywhere near that. Not yet. You've got a bit of a journey to go first. But if you have a high functioning and a very, open and lighthearted team, it's a highly effective way to normalize that failure and then normalize that learning in that. So bring that back, right context. You need to be funding, and you need to be, more importantly, building in that culture of openness, which is happy to fail, happy to succeed, and happy to reflect. The third element you need to be building in as part of a learning PMO is having the right conversations. Now, and don't come after me with pitchforks for saying this, but the vast majority of lessons learned sessions that I've been in have been boring. Mm-hmm. They've been dry, and they're typically railroaded one of two ways. You typically have a couple of people in the room who are louder than the rest, and they drive the conversation either to, this project was absolutely amazing and did everything right, or this project was an absolute mess and here's all the things that went wrong.
Right.
Again, you're nodding. So I feel like, you know, you might have experienced similarly.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's actually an alternative way to have that conversation. In fact, to actually build it in. And so there's a concept called learning journeys. I'm not going to claim credit for that. I've picked it up on my journey somewhere. I don't know where. But it really leverages the power of storytelling. So, you know, we humans, before we could write, we've been telling stories for even longer than that. It's a primary mechanism in terms of how we communicate with each other. And so when you're able to leverage that storytelling in what you're doing, you mentioned earlier, how do I explain the admin death cycle? Well, I tell the story, you know, a similar to the way that I've just done, you know, here. It's the same with our learning. If we build in learning journeys into our projects, into our PMOs, then we're able to move past that dryness and you start shifting it. And so I'll quickly explain to you what I'm talking about here. If you imagine a whiteboard, and imagine a horizontal line on a whiteboard. Again, I said I like whiteboards. But imagine a horizontal line. Everything above the horizontal line is a positive plot point. And everything below the horizontal line is a negative plot point. And what you do, you get your teams and you get your PMO or you get your project in the room and you say, let's tell the story of our last 2 weeks, of our last sprint, of our last month, whatever time frame, let's tell the story. And so you start to, rather than saying what went well and what didn't go well, and you know, how could we have done cost management better or whatever the case may be, you start telling a story as a team. Oh, this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened. And it becomes a little bit event driven, but ultimately the team is telling the story. Mm-hmm. And then after you've got the story all mapped out, and it's a wonderful novel, typically of highs and lows, and it's wonderful. You then layer that with, okay, well, what did we learn? What did we learn from this? What did we learn from that? You know, what are the key things that are coming out? And so you're no longer asking what went well. You're saying, what did we learn from this event in our lives that we all went through together?
Right.
And it's a different conversation. And you build that in, not at the end of a stage or anything else, but you build that in throughout. And you have that as a regular cadence. And again, that normalizes this idea of learning.
I love that. And often we forget at the end of the project what everything happened anyway. So to build it into your normal cadence, it just makes much more sense in that way. And to your point, storytelling is a lot easier to palletize, if that's the right word, easier to intake than somebody pointing a finger at you, telling you what you did wrong the entire project. So those are all great pieces of advice, Brendan. And I also think in our everyday lives, we can also just take PMO out of the kind of everything that Brendan just said right there. You can also capture a lot of those, that guidance and those tips and things like that when you're trying to figure out your own purpose in your everyday life, right? Trying to figure out what you could do better in your day, how you could be more productive, whatever it is that your goals are for your personal lives, you utilize that advice as well. But then also in your professional lives, if you're a PM or not, you know, encourage your organizations to get behind these types of practices and also do them in the way that Brendan said, because at least then it's a lot more fun than just sitting in a room bored out of your mind while, you know, two people in the room talk about what went well and what didn't. So absolutely, Brendan. I love all of that piece, all of that you just said. I hope that the audience is able to capture that as well and start to utilize some of that framework within their organization. So that'd be fantastic. But Brendan, I think you've given us a lot to think about. I can probably pick your brain about this the entire day, which I know we each also respectively have very busy days ahead of us. So I want to first thank you for your time to join us on the Everyday PM podcast, because I know it's an early day for you, early start for you. So first and foremost, thank you for that. But in terms of people who are interested in picking up any of the books that you've published and in hearing more of that practical advice and things that they can utilize within their respective careers and lives as well, where can they find your books?
So I'm at valuablechange.com, but in all honesty, my books are Amazon, Google, and anywhere you want to look for them. Creating High Value PMOs is both paperback and audiobook. And Valuable Change is paperback, and depending on when this comes out, maybe audiobook by then. The audiobook is currently being recorded and should be out fantastic. By the end of 2021, which is awesome. That's where I am. I'm very, very highly accessible. Send me an email, send me a question. I'm absolutely always happy to have a chat, always happy to help wherever I can. And it's funny, you mentioned that, you know, it's applicable in our everyday lives. And it's mm-hmm. interesting because that's not the first time I've received that feedback. In fact, I mm-hmm. handed my grandfather a copy of Valuable Change, my other book. My grandfather has nothing to do with change management, nothing to do with project management, nothing to do with change leadership, nothing about that. But you know, he understands enough of the corporate world to get what I'm chatting about. And he read that and he said, basically, you know, majority of this is applicable to my everyday life.
Yes, exactly.
It's, you know, change or not. And so that's it's a wonderful piece of feedback, but highly recommend picking it up, and I'm curious to see if it's the same for your listeners.
I agree. And my listeners are all over the place, right? So not necessarily project managers by trade, by title, none of that. They're just here listening in just to get that practical advice. So yes, absolutely. I think both of your books will serve great, tremendous value to our audience. So thank you for sharing your knowledge on that. I think Brendan, you're also on LinkedIn. So I'll make sure that the connection is made there with our audience as well, if they want to connect with you there. Anywhere other platforms that you wanted to promote before we call it today?
I'm primarily on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook as well, but LinkedIn is really where I hang out more, in all honesty. I do also have a weekly newsletter, which is the Change Leader Weekly. So if you want to hear whatever I'm thinking about that week, then jump on that. That's to be honest, it's rapidly growing in terms of readership, which is brilliant. It's a nice sign, and that's growing quite organically. So highly recommend jumping on that as well.
That's great to hear. Yes. I will make sure all the links, anything that Brendan just promoted, is all accessible on this post when this podcast goes up as well. You can follow me on LinkedIn as well. That is also my community. I live and breathe there too. And also support the Everyday PM podcast. We are available on every podcasting platform there is, especially Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, you name it. Feel free to check us out, subscribe, follow, whatever it is that you have to do to support. You can see the video version of this on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/AnnCampia. So if you want to just see us talk, you can too. And also go ahead and subscribe, follow, do everything that you can to support me there. So that will do it for Brendan and I in this installment of the Everyday PM podcast. Thank you guys so much for joining us today. And until next time, take care.